I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Welcome to Minute 41 of Season 6 of Movie on Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic It's a Wonderful Life, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Todd Liebenow of the Forgotten Filmcast. Welcome back to the show, Todd.
Absolutely. Great to be back. Always fun to be on this show. You always pick great movies to talk about, so it's cool to be back.
Yeah, and I always like having you on as a guest, especially, you know, I try to get you on some great minutes, you know, so, yeah.
you always ask what you want, and I'm always like, whatever, just pick whatever. I think the only time I actually specifically requested ones was when you
was playing Trains and Automobiles. Yeah.
Because there were scenes that were shot in my wife's hometown, which what's interesting that? Enough, Bedford Falls reminds me a lot of my wife's hometown, to be honest with you. Just kind of the style of the streets and the buildings and things like that. A little bit of my hometown, but more so my wife's hometown.
You think that Woodstock and wait, it's Woodstock, right?
Yeah, Woodstock, yeah, Illinois.
Woodstock, Illinois, and Bedford Falls and fake Bedford Falls, New York, you think are the same place, more or less? Could this theoretically be the same town?
No, but I mean, that's interesting because, you know, of course, you know, as we've discussed, Woodstock, Illinois is where they shot Groundhog Day. So, you know, you could have It's a Wonderful Life just repeating over and over again if that were the case. But
well, how do we know that didn't happen?
It could have happened for all we know. Yeah. No, I mean, it's just kind of the dynamic of the town. I mean, it's, you know, I can't really say that I grew up in a small town. I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. You know, I mean, it's its own community and such, but it's a part of the greater Chicagoland area. Whereas where my wife grew up, Woodstock is a bit more separated from the rest of the Chicagoland area. You know, it's more like that small town feel. And I guess that's kind of what I think about with Bedford Falls.
You know? Okay. All right. So it's like you have to go from Pittsburgh to Punxsutawney, you know, that type of
right
thing. Yeah, you know, so yeah. You know, the same type of thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. I mean, I as you know, I grew up in the suburbs also. I didn't grow up in the small town, you know. I grew up in the suburbs of Detroit, so, you know, I've never had that small town feel, you know, except for when I watch movies like this, you know.
yeah I think, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know. I think there's more of that, you know, like everybody knows everybody type of a vibe where, you know, of course, it's not that way. There's no way you could know everybody in town, you know, but you just kind of, there's more of that sense of community and such. And I suppose even in the suburbs, you get that to an extent just within your own maybe neighborhood and circle and stuff like that. But I think in a small town like what Bedford Falls kind of represents, it's more of that feel where just, you know, we all know each other and we all know so-and-so runs the pharmacy and so-and-so runs the savings and loan and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Right. I mean, we've talked about this over the last few weeks, and I'm assuming I think we might even talk about it this week. The fact that, you know, not everyone really knows everyone else, even though it is a small town feel. You know, maybe everyone knows that you go to Gower's drugstore in order to get poison, or you go there, you know, either poison or getting a hot fudge sundae, you know, without coconuts, where he clearly puts tons of coconut on it. So I don't know.
Poison coconut. Yeah, no, absolutely.
That's right. it's very possible. But, you know, the whole idea, though, is, you know, this movie is supposed to give you that small town feeling because, You know, they want us to believe that everyone knows George Bailey and George Bailey knows everybody, and that's part of the quote unquote miracle of this movie. You know, because he's able to affect everyone there. I mean, in the suburb that you grew up in, Chicago, or the suburb that I grew up in, Detroit, you know, we didn't know everybody. Now, nobody knew us. Or not everyone knew us. I don't think it's the type of thing that we could say that if either one of us wasn't born and wasn't growing up there, you know, that people would be that much affected. Yeah, in the same way that George Bailey.
Not in the same scale, yeah.
No, obviously not on the same scale. You know, so what actually is your background with It's a Wonderful Life? I mean, you mentioned before that I keep picking great movies. I pick movies that I like, and I always pick movies that I know that I will have a lot to talk about along with my guests. So, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I'm going this far back. You know, 77 years is the furthest I've been back going through these movies. But so what's your background with it?
So I remember very clearly when I was introduced to It's a Wonderful Life, my eighth grade history teacher showed it to our class. I say history. I think that technically it would have been social studies class back then. Yeah. But, you know, I'm sure it was just a thing like, you know, we were coming up on Christmas and she needed some time, you know, and wanted to have something that was not too difficult. And so she put on a movie for 2 days. And so, yeah, Miss Zek's class, eighth grade, we watched It's a Wonderful Life. And it was really one of my first exposures to movies from this era, you know, outside of like watching The Wizard of Oz every year on TV.
Colorized, probably.
You know, actually, no, we weren't at colorization yet.
No, I'm talking about for The Wizard of Oz. I'm talking about The Wizard of Oz.
But yeah, so I remember watching this in school when I was in middle school, and just really was fascinated by it. I was like, wow, that's a great movie, you know. And then of course, you know, would catch it as it showed on TV, because this is the era where it showed on TV all the time around Christmas. Every channel showed this. You know, it was where this, I mean, It's a Wonderful Life was what a lot of TV stations would go to, like on Thanksgiving Day, for example. Like if you'd watch the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade and then they'd put on It's a Wonderful Life, and you could literally switch the dial and find it playing on several stations at the same time, because it was a public domain movie. And so that's like, that's the reason why, for example, Night of the Living Dead would show up on station after station all the time, because it was public domain and they could get a cruddy copy and show it no problem. So, yeah, It's a Wonderful Life showed up on multiple TV stations, sometimes at the same time, all throughout the holiday season. But the first time watching it was at school. So, yeah, I will always remember that.
Oh, wow. And is it something that you watch yearly or just –
I think it was type one of those type of things where maybe I would see bits and pieces of it, you know, like you'd be flipping the dial and it'd be on and you'd watch a little bit here and there. I don't know that I had that many complete viewings of it after that initial viewing, but I've certainly seen it here and there. And I mean, really, it had been many years since I had seen the whole thing through and just actually sat down and watched it. And you were the cause of me watching it again in full, because we were on an episode of the Lambcast and you won the vote for having it be the Christmas movie of the month.
Wow, that was a year. That was a
that
year.
Ago. Yeah. Was that last year? I was trying to remember exactly.
Yeah, it was last year. Last year.
Yeah. And so, you know, that was the first time I had sat down and rewatched it in full in quite a while. And, you know, it is just a great movie. I mean, it's one of those where you watch it and you go, if this doesn't get to you in some way, I mean, you have no soul. I mean, it's as simple as that. It's it's just one of those great movies.
Well, and did you convince a family member to rewatch it with you at this point?
I did not. I wish I had. I mean, my kids are both adults now and have crazy schedules, and you know, it's hard to wrangle them to sit down and watch something with me. So no, I did it solo.
No, because I know you did that for Die Hard, you know, and Die Hard 2. You got, yeah. you, you got your son to join you for them. So,
I did. I got my son to join me for Die Hard 2 because, we had only made it as far as Die Hard 1 with that. And I was like, I need you to watch Die Hard 2 with me because, and part of the reason that I think I might have said this to you when we did the show, I was like, I like Die Hard 2 a lot, but I really wanted to get to Die Hard with a Vengeance with my son because I think that's the second best of the Die Hard movies. And I know my son loves Samuel L. Jackson, so I was like, we got to watch this. This is one of the best Samuel L. Jackson movies. So,
you'll have to wait another season for that one.
Yeah, but and I mean, we can't skip. I couldn't skip over Die Hard 2 and go right to Die Hard with a Vengeance. So,
yeah, no, of course not. That would be blasphemy, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Sacrosanct. Okay, so episode 41 begins, or minute 41 begins with George being confronted by his mother, Ma Bailey, and ends with George being pointed towards the right. So we ended things on Friday with George, standing outside, having left this big party that they've made for his brother and new sister-in-law. And, he helps his uncle on his way. We got to see the whole Uncle Billy thing, which we talked about last week with the garbage can and all that stuff. And he's just standing there now with his mother, with Ma Bailey. And, they're sort of, I guess you could say, having a moment together with this whole thing. And it makes you wonder, what does George really think about the fact that, Harry has just returned home and has basically screwed him over, more or less?
Yeah, I'm sure this will come up a lot in this the next couple of days here. I can relate to George a lot just because I'm kind of that same guy who doesn't want to rock the boat, who's like, sometimes things may not go my way, but it's hard for me to be like, well, I'm going to stand up for myself, or I'm going to be assertive and do this thing, or, I'm going to say this thing that is really on my mind or whatever. George, and we'll get to it more as we go here. I mean, George doesn't realize that, I mean, Mary's like a sure thing. and
he doesn't realize plotting, it though.
He needs people to push him in the right direction. I'm very much that kind of person at times, especially, we'll get to this more, I'm sure. I don't want to jump the gun here, but when it came to when I met my future wife and she was showing interest in me and stuff, I was clueless. I definitely needed pushing. I'm glad she was as assertive as she was. She was more like Mary, was trying to get on board with the fact that she liked me. So
yeah, I hope you've asked Amy if she's actually still happy about that decision. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're going to be coming up on 30 years here this next summer, so I'm assuming she is. So.
I hope so. So basically, Ma Bailey says to him, "Stop that grunting." Hmm. And then she says, "Can you give me one good reason why you shouldn't call on Mary?" So again, the whole idea, I mean, first of all, it's been 4 years since we're assuming 3 or 4 years since the dance where he saw Mary. And, his father has been dead for that amount of time also. And it's very interesting that his mother is prodding him in the direction to, both literally and figuratively, that basically Mary is the right one for him. And as you mentioned before, I mean, George is completely clueless about this. It doesn't really, it's not even something that's on his mind. His mind is on, adventures that have now just, the balloon has been popped. Mm-hmm. He had these ideas of what he was going to do, and that's no longer there. Now he needs to refigure things, what he's going to do now that Harry, is now married, and Harry has this great job opportunity. And, and it's not even staying in Bedford Falls. If I remember correctly, it's in Buffalo where he needs to go, which we don't know the exact distance to Buffalo because We don't know where Bedford Falls specifically
Yeah, where
is.
is Bedford Falls exactly?
It's somewhere in New York, you know, upstate New York or whatever it is. You know, but what they're trying to show here is that his mother still knows best. She's aware of what's going on. She's aware that Mary is very interested in George. I don't know where she would have known this from, because, you know, when has she seen? We're not sure when she's seen Mary.
Well, again, as we were saying earlier, it's a small town, the quote unquote everybody knows everybody type of thing. So, the idea that so and so likes I mean, she's got her eyes open,
Okay, well,
she's
you know
probably
what?
figured it
Let's
out.
go through the dialogue and try and understand it. So, like, why? Give me one reason why you shouldn't call on Mary. So George says, "Sure, Sam Wainwright." And then his mother looks at him and goes, "Hee-haw." Now, I find that hilarious. I never noticed this without, you know, I've seen this movie dozens of times. I've never noticed that she says "hee-haw." You know, throughout the movie, they have
Yeah, no,
the,
I.
you know, their signal between the friends, you know, between Sam and George and Marty, and you also have it at the, you know, at the beginning with Harry also, you know, the whole hee-haw thing. But I never realized that that was Sam Wainwright's nickname, I
Like a
guess.
nickname.
That's right.
Yeah,
And that
no,
his
it.
mother calls him hee-haw.
No, that didn't register with me either. But. Yeah, I mean it's an odd name. It's almost like a name you would see out of a character like out of the Little Rascals or something like that,
Exactly. Well, this is
which I guess is,
1932.
and it's fitting too because I mean
We did have alfalfa
of
on a
course,
few weeks ago.
yeah,
Yeah.
there's a little rascal in this movie, which
That's right.
always blows me away every time I watch
That's
this
right.
movie. I'm like, oh yeah, Alfalfa's in this movie.
That's right. And then it just, like, I was trying to think about it. Have my parents or myself, you know, did my parents ever call any of my friends by nicknames? Or do I ever call my children's kids by their nicknames? No, you know, it's
No.
what I'm trying to remember what TV show it was. For some reason, it's hitting. I'm thinking of Leave It to Beaver, but I don't think it's Leave It to Beaver because
Oh,
I was thinking of Eddie
well, like
Haskell type of thing. You know,
I know one that just came to mind that was along those lines. So, remember the show Growing Pains?
yes.
Okay. And didn't Kirk Cameron's character have a buddy who had just the worst nickname you could ever do
What was
for
he, like,
a
Booger or something
family
like that?
sitcom? I think it was Boner. I think
That's right.
Boner was the
That's
nickname.
right.
And like the mom and dad called him Boner on the show.
Yeah. The truth is that word is not necessarily, you know, a bad word at all times. I remember I was reading a Hardy Boy
Right.
book, you know, that the Hardy Boy books came out when the 50s, 60s, 70s. I don't even remember when they were. And they mentioned somewhere, don't give that old guy a boner. And the idea was, is
Right.
it was like the connotation is completely different. They're, you know,
It's like a mistake or something like that, I think is what the slang meant. Like, to pull a
it's that's
boner
right.
was
It
to
is
make a mistake.
a
Yeah.
stupid mistake. That's right.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know how they got away with that with the with the censors in the 80s. But yeah, you're right. But you sure that his parents called him that? The parents called his friend that. I think they called him by his
I'm
real
pretty
name. Maybe
sure.
his, I think for some reason I'm thinking his real name was Richard, but I don't know, which would also be fitting.
I think you're right. I think I think his last name was like Stabone or something like that. It had bone in it somehow, so that's where Boner came from.
Yeah, I think so. It was something like that. But you know, I think his first name was maybe Richard, which is somewhat fitting. Yes, that's right. His name was Richard Boner Stabone. There you go. Played by
See?
Andrew Koenig. And
That's
he was
right, Walter Koenig's
that's
son.
right. And
Yes, from Star Trek.
he was only on 25 episodes of Growing Pains, which is one more episode than Leonardo DiCaprio.
Leonardo DiCaprio, the cousin Oliver of Growing Pains.
That's right. That's right. Wow, did you know that he died? Andrew Koenig?
I did know that. Yeah, as soon as you said that, I was like, oh, that's right. He's Walter Koenig's son, and I seem to remember seeing an interview with Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and made reference to his son's passing at some point.
Yeah, he committed suicide in 2010. Wow.
Yeah, Growing Pains was, I mean, I watched that one all the time. It was Who's the Boss was on, and then Growing Pains after that.
Well, yeah. Okay, so there we go. There is an example, but I can't think of any real examples from my life of mm-hmm. where I would call my children's friends by a nickname or whatever. You know, you call them by the name, you know.
Right.
The name exactly. that your parents gave you. That's what it comes down to. Mm-hmm. And then the mother, George responds, yes, Sam's crazy about Mary. And she responds, well, she's not crazy about him. Well, how do you know? What, did she discuss it with you? No. Well, then how do you know? Well, I've got eyes, haven't I? Why, she lights up like a firefly whenever you're around. So again, it goes back to the fact that, okay, you know, she mentioned last week that Mary is back in town, but, you know, she lights up like a firefly whenever she sees George. So where conceivably did George see her recently and not know that he saw her?
Mom's crafty. Moms can be crafty. She's trying to get him hooked up, and that's that. Yeah. The firefly line made me laugh a little bit because it's weird. When I see things where fireflies are referenced, I go, oh yeah, fireflies, because we don't have them here in Colorado. I grew up, like we said, in the Chicago area, and, you know, summer nights, fireflies are out. We go out, catch fireflies, all that kind of stuff. But we don't have them here. I don't know if it's the altitude or what, but it's just, they're not here. And so like when I used to take, we'd go in the summer and visit my parents back in the Chicago area, my kids, one of the biggest thrills for them was the fact that there were fireflies and they go see these, because it just was not a thing that, it, you know, their regular lives here in Colorado, they don't get to experience those. So fireflies are like a new exotic thing to my family ever since moving to Colorado.
Oh, wow. That's actually really funny. Yeah. No, I at this part of the world, we don't get fireflies either. So I haven't seen fireflies since I was a kid. You know, but I don't really miss them.
They're fun to catch when you're a kid, but they could be a little annoying and creepy too. Like you're just sitting there and they would brush up against you and they just, yeah.
Right.
But they're cool looking.
That's true. That's true. And, I mean, I guess it's just motherly intuition, this whole thing. I think that's what it comes down to, you know, that, yep. But as you said, George is completely oblivious. You know, doesn't know anything about what's going on, stuff like that. Did you notice in the background we see everyone, like people dancing in the background throughout this whole thing?
Yes.
You know, it's like the party is going full steam even without George and Ma Bailey. You know, we don't need that.
Very busy backgrounds in general over these next couple minutes, I've noticed.
That's true. Yes, we will mention that later in the week. We will get to some very interesting things that are going on in the background.
But I did catch it in this scene specifically because, yeah, it's basically you see the silhouette of people dancing back there. Mm-hmm. Am I right? Was it silhouette?
Yeah.
And silhouette stuff always intrigues me because
you're a puppet guy. You
know, we've talked about it before. When I'm a puppet guy, I'm a puppeteer, I've done quite a bit with shadow puppets. And, that was something where many years ago when we were working on a production and we said, let's do some shadow puppets. And it's something I really had to kind of investigate myself and try and learn some stuff about. And so I've always just ever since then been intrigued with using silhouettes to kind of tell a story and such. So that was neat to see.
Yeah, it very much is. And then George basically said, oh, and then his mother says, besides, Sam Wainwright's away in New York. And you're here in Bedford Falls. And then George looks at her and goes, and all's fair in love and war. Now, do you know where that phrase comes from?
I do not. I've heard it many times, but yeah, I don't know where that's from.
Yeah, so I actually looked it up, surprisingly, you know, me looking something up, you know.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, so there is a novel that was written in 1578 called Euphues, I think that's how it's pronounced, Euphues, The Anatomy of Wit, which was published in 1578 by John Lyly. It was a novel, and that is the earliest known origin of the idea of all is fair in love and war, because the novel is about the romantic adventures of a wealthy and attractive young man, and it has a quote in it that says, "The rules of fair play do not apply in love and war." So basically what they're saying here is that, you know, nothing is off limits when you're dealing with either war or when you're in love. You know, killing the enemy is justified. Spying, torture, lying, cheating, backstabbing, and making deals with the enemy are all fair game. And, you know, I guess when it comes to love, it's the same type of thing, even though it's the exact opposite of war, which is, you know, which is funny to use that as the analogy here. Basically, they're saying, you know, you can go through the whole gamut, the whole spectrum, from love to war, or from war to love, you know, that there are, you know, usually there are accepted rules and limits, but if you break them and you you end up winning, you know, then, you know, no one really cares from that perspective.
Yeah. I kind of, as I watch the scene, I feel like, you know, like I would have been the guy who missed out, you know, like, like I'm Sam Wainwright, yeah, it's stealing away from not that Sam Wainwright really had a chance to, but
that's right.
No, and then that phrase in Love and War too. I mean, you know, we're both movie guys, so my brain is always wired movies, and so I hear in Love and War, and I go, oh, he's going, wasn't that a Sandra Bullock movie?
Sandra Bullock and Chris O'Donnell, exactly.
Yeah, of course. He played Ernest Hemingway in that. Yeah,
yeah. I actually didn't really like that movie very much. I rewatched it like a year ago, I think, or a year and a half ago, and I wasn't too impressed with it, even though it has great.
Saw it once, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So, me too. And George responds and says, well, I don't know about war. I guess so. He's agreeing that it is all fair in love, you know, which, you know, he's not sure about that in war, which is ironic that this phrase was written into this movie, which was being, you know, it was being written during World War II, you know, okay. Even though this takes place more than a decade earlier, you know, this point of the movie. And then he goes, mother of mine, I can see right through you, right to your back collar button.
What a weird.
Actually, you know what? I made a mistake. It was his mother who says, I don't know about war.
Ah, okay.
It was the mother's. So, I mean, the comment is his mother says, I don't know about war, but she is the one who knows about love. Because what does George know about love? George is. What does he know?
He's clueless.
He's completely clueless, but he's like maybe 25 at this point. No, he's around 25, I think.
Yeah.
I think he was born, his character was supposed to be born in 1907, if I remember correctly. So if this is 1932, so he's exactly 25 at this point. But, you know, we saw even when he was in the soda shop at the beginning, when Mary and Violet were oogling him. You know, he didn't really know anything about that at that point either. He's even though he wanted a harem, but whatever.
Yeah, he didn't show any interest in the two girls there, but he wanted a harem. Yeah,
correct. Yeah, and then and then George says to his mother, "Mother of mine, I can see right through you, right to your back collar button. Trying to get rid of me, huh? Mm-hmm. Well." Here's your hat. And I love the way she like places his hat on his head as if she's been holding it and just crumples it on his head.
Well, and what's weird too is when I was watching that scene, I was like, it looks like the hat just comes from out of nowhere.
Yes.
Because she's so much smaller than him.
That's right.
And suddenly this hat pops on his head.
That's like, right.
Where did that come from?
It's from a someone on the side, you know, a what's going on? a crew member on the side is just quickly giving it to him, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but because it doesn't really go in his head very well either. And then, I mean, I find this a little strange, but I was doing a little research and I understand that it might not be so strange. But then he gives his mother a kiss on the lips.
Yeah, I agree.
You know,
I mean, that's one of the big things in my notes right here is like, yep, that's a little strange.
Yeah, I find it a little strange. But again, I was doing a little bit of research and I was basically told that there are families where this is considered appropriate. So I mean, I'm not going to go into trying to figure out whether it's right or wrong. Apparently in their family, that was okay. You know, so I think we'll just leave it at that.
And I take it too that in, you know, different cultures and, you know, maybe different countries and things like that, there is a background of that more. I mean, like, you know.
No, but this isn't kissing twice like, on the cheek and stuff like that, you know.
Oh yeah, this isn't Michael kissing Fredo or whatever.
That's right. That's, maybe it is. Maybe that's what George is saying.
There
George,
you go.
George is saying you're sending me off to Mary's. Here is a kiss of death.
I knew it was you, Ma Bailey.
That's right. And then he says, "What's your hurry?" And then he goes, "All right, mother, old building and lone pal, I think I'll go out and find a girl and do a little passionate necking. Oh, George, now if you'll just point me in the right direction." Now, first of all, I gotta mention this once again in one of my movies. The term pal has come up. You know, this is something that came up twice in with the Die Hards. You know, in the original Die Hard and Die Hard 2, they used the term pal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was how, you know, John and Al were talking. You know, throughout the original Die Hard, they kept, you know, he kept calling him pal. And
there's a line too where he says, "Welcome to the party, pal."
That's right, exactly. And then we had Esperanzo say, he says it to Esperanzo. He calls him pal. You know, so it does come up. I believe I was trying to think if it came up in when Harry Met Sally. It didn't come up in, but I was wondering if it was in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. But I didn't have time to check it. But I have a feeling it didn't.
I don't remember.
But okay, three out of six so far is not bad. Not that this is a criteria for me to pick which movies, you know, I'm going to do by looking for the word pal, but I just thought it was interesting, you know. And then, you know, he said, "Just point me in the right direction." So she points him to the right, and then he goes this direction, and then walks off a camera towards the right.
which if we end there, leaves you with the wrong impression.
Well, it leaves you with the right impression.
I guess you're right. Exactly.
But that's what's fun about doing this minute by minute. You know, we only, you know, our discussion today only involves this minute. It doesn't matter anything. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it does not matter what happens in tomorrow's minute. We'll have to worry about that tomorrow, not today.
Exactly.
All right. So did you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
No, I think we're good.
All right. So Monday's segment is Capra Monday, where basically my guests will give their top five Frank Capra movies, starting with number five and working your way up. So what have you got for us, Todd?
So here's the thing, Rob. I am ashamed to admit that and I didn't even realize how big of a blind spot it was for me, but I have not seen a whole lot of Frank Capra movies, I realized.
Okay.
Getting ready for this. And as I looked at things, I was like, I've only seen four Frank Capra directed feature films. Now,
okay, there's more than five, Jay, though. There's more than Jay, because Jay's only seen three.
I could give you, I could do the full five though, because I'm going to give you an answer for my number five that I would think nobody else is going to give you, because there is a fifth film directed by Frank Capra I have seen. It's a short.
Okay.
It's Our Mr. Sun, because I remember seeing that in school. You know, like they pulled out the projector and put this thing on. And I remember this educational short that I think was produced by Bell Telephone or something like that. And it's got this There's a scientist and another guy who I think, if I remember correctly, is played by Eddie Albert. They're talking all about the sun, and there's this animated sun thing. And Frank Capra did a couple of these animated films, and I have a vivid memory of seeing this weird little film in school. So, go look at it on YouTube. It's public domain. Our Mr. Sun. So I'm going to make that my number five.
All
so
right, I can get to five. It's a short, but it's an hour. An hour, and it has Eddie Albert and Lionel Barrymore.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
So anyway, so I'll make that number five.
Perfect.
Number four, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Number three, It Happened One Night. Number two, this ranks higher because it's an all-time favorite of my wife's, and we've watched it together a few times, Arsenic and Old Lace.
Mm-hmm.
And number one, It's a Wonderful Life.
Well, okay, great. That is a great list. Just so you know, you're not the first person to choose a Frank Capra short. You know, we've had other people that have used shorts. One of them was Rendezvous in Space, which I went and watched afterwards, and it was amazing. It really is. Another short.
Oh yeah, I admit I am intrigued by old educational films. As a matter of fact, on my podcast, every episode, I throw in a few weird clips here and there when the show is just getting started. And a lot of times those weird audio clips that I'm pulling are from old educational films, because I just think there's some wonderful, weird, crazy dialogue in those things. And those films definitely count as forgotten films as well. So I like to kind of salute the educational films like Our Mr. Sun. I've definitely used clips from Our Mr. Sun on the podcast before.
Oh, wow. Very cool. All right. So, Todd, you want to tell people where they can find Todd Liebenow?
Yeah, so the blog is called Forgotten Films. It's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. And then my podcast is called The Forgotten Filmcast. And you can find that wherever you find your podcasts. And I'm on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, or you can find me. I'm still going to call it Twitter. Doesn't matter. I don't get this whole X thing. Just easier.
The artist formerly known as Twitter.
That's right. And my website, movieroundminute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow. Life with its tears.